The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It seems to me that we have an obligation to demonstrate that we have skin in the game. If we want to continue to be a leader on these issues. First, it's important because it communicates this critical commitment to burden sharing. Turkey's hosting more than 2 million Syrian refugees, Lebanon more than 1 million. Jordan's numbers are estimated in the order of about 650,000. If we're asking them, and if we're asking our European friends and allies to take on responsibilities, our failure to do so won't only be perceived as an expression of hypocrisy, but also diminished leadership. The battle against ISIS is a worldwide effort in which ISIS and its use of social media and other means of communication, they offer this apocalyptic vision of conflict that rejects any notion of the compatibility of Islam and other traditions. The United States has welcomed persecuted Muslims from around the world in our refugee resettlement program. It's a highly effective rebuke of this preposterous ISIS notion.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 9th, 2016. That is the voice of Eric Schwartz explaining why the United States has an interest in alleviating the Syrian refugee crisis. Schwartz is the dean of the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. He previously served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration. In our conversation, he sketched the key aspects of U.S. refugee policy and explained how it both protects the security of the United States and at times undermines its ability to accept refugees. Schwartz outlines what a coherent refugee policy would look like and argues that the reforms must go beyond simply accepting more refugees. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 165, Eric Schwartz, Refugee Policy and the Syrian Civil War.
All right, so let's start with your involvement in this area. We've had a lot of discussion on the site about refugees and Syrian refugees in particular and the political and security dimensions of that conversation. We've had almost none of it from people who have sort of direct experience in the refugee admissions process. So let's start by just giving us some background on who you are relative to this conversation.
Instagram pictures of yourself listening to the Lawfare podcast. Do whatever you need to do, and as always, thanks for listening.
For better or worse, I probably had as much experience as a practitioner at a senior level as most anyone in the refugee admissions area. During the Clinton administration, between 1993 and 2000. I ultimately served as a senior director and special assistant to the president for multilateral and humanitarian affairs. But throughout that 8-year period, I was the principal national security staff member with responsibility for the U.S. refugee program and international humanitarian response more broadly. Recently, in the first part of the Obama administration, I served as Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, which is not only the principal humanitarian officer at the Department of State, but also the person with responsibility for the U.S. refugee admissions program. I also had other positions in the NGO and community and with the United Nations, where I also dealt with these issues in one way or another. But those two experiences in the government are probably my principal involvement.
So when you talk about U.S. and refugee admissions, you hear two things all the time. One is that, you know, we take a lot of refugees, and we're the sort of world leader in refugee resettlement. And the second thing is we've taken almost no Syrian refugees. We're way behind the Europeans, that there's something sort of morally deficient about our posture with respect to the current crisis. So I'm wondering if you can sort of unpack this a little bit and describe as a general matter the U.S. posture toward refugees, both in general and in this particular conflict.
Well, there's more than a germ of truth in each one of those apparently conflicting statements, so I think unpacking it is very important. First, when we talk about refugees, we're talking refugees. The definition of refugee is a person who is outside their country of origin and has a well-founded fear of persecution. And that is an internationally defined term, it doesn't require, in an existential sense, it doesn't require a government to designate you as a refugee. If that is the definition you fit, then you're a refugee. And governments have processes that recognize that status and thereby confer benefits. And in the United States, there are really two ways that people become refugees. There is the through the U.S. There are two ways that people become recognized as refugees. There is the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program, the latest iteration of which was authorized by the 1980 Refugee Act. Under that program, which when we talk about refugee resettlement, that's really what we're generally talking about, each year the President of the United States, based on recommendations from the Department of State, makes a judgment about how many refugees the United States is prepared to take in, usually from countries where they are in some sort of safe haven, from countries to which they have fled. And that's why the term is often referred to as third country resettlement, because a refugee in an individual in Somalia flees to Kenya, and that's where he or she receives safe haven, and then is resettled through essentially a discretionary process by the United States into the United States, and that's referred to as third country resettlement. In recent years, that has been done by U.S. officials in closer collaboration with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Now, to be sure, worldwide, the United States resettles through these kinds of essentially discretionary programs a very high percentage, perhaps more than half, of the world's refugees who are resettled through these kinds of programs. In recent years, the United States has resettled about 70,000 a year through these processes. And so we can take pride in the fact that we are that we do such a high percentage of this resettlement. Per capita, we are not the top. Other governments do more, but nonetheless, and we probably resettle on the order of half of all those who are resettled through that process. But the other way that people become recognized as refugees is they simply cross borders. And, the hundreds of thousands of people who are entering Europe are not entering through these kinds of refugee resettlement programs, but the vast majority of them will be deemed to be refugees, right? So in the case of the Syrians, and others who Afghanis and other populations that are crossing into Europe, when we say we resettle half of the world's refugees, we're not including those groups of people, because that's really through the system of asylum, and it's a much more unmanaged system, but it also results in refugee resettlement. So that's the framework. That's the frame. Now, should I answer the second part of your question? Because I heard it sounds like you have.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So in the Syria case, Syrians are not crossing our southern borders in large numbers, and so if we don't take a political decision to resettle large numbers of Syrians, then large numbers of Syrians won't be resettled in the United States. And many of us, myself included, have strongly argued that the United States has both a strategic interest and a humanitarian interest in resettling much larger numbers of Syrians than we have been prepared to date to resettle. And we can talk about that. I'd be happy to talk about why I think this is very important, both for strategic reasons as well as for humanitarian reasons.
So we'll get to that in a moment, but I want to unpack one element of what you just said. So when you say that Syrians aren't crossing the southern border, is it fair as a general matter to say that the U.S. posture toward refugees is that because we don't have refugee crises leading to people flowing onto our shores or across our borders organically, except occasional waves of Cubans or Haitians, we have the luxury of sort of deciding what are the groups that we want to take, and so we tend to do it in a sort of more relaxed long-term way as long-term resettlement rather than sort of short-term crisis management. Is that the sort of tectonic plate level of the way the U.S. thinks about refugees, or is that just sort of reading a lot into?
Well, there's something to that, but I would make a couple of points. First of all, we have demonstrated in the past some capacity to deal with more emergency-like situations. We have not demonstrated that capacity in the current situation, but in the case of Indochinese refugees fleeing after the war, in the case of Kosovars, in the case of Kurds who were fleeing northern Iraq in the mid-1990s, we have demonstrated a capacity to move quickly and provide, in the first instance, some degree of refuge, and in the second instance, resettlement in situations that were more emergency-like. But I think your basic comment, which is that the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program is not fundamentally a rescue program, is probably accurate. My concern is I think we ought to have at least some better capacity to act more quickly and in emergent situations for a variety of reasons. And I think the other point I would make is we do have a refugees crossing our border issue in the United States, our southern border, with respect to Central Americans, and that's an issue which which we also have not demonstrated a terrific capacity to deal with both effectively and in as humane a manner as we could. So I don't want to pretend that those sorts of issues don't exist for us. The only other point I would make is, and the obvious, yes, that the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program and other countries' third country resettlement programs are in large measure designed to address issues of protracted refugee situations that have existed over many years, with an understanding that refugee resettlement is only going to be a solution for a tiny percentage of the world's refugees under the best of circumstances.
So one of the other things that we hear you know, both sides of on a regular basis. And this one strikes me as a circle that can't be squared, not a circle like the one we started with that actually has elements of truth to both. You hear simultaneously there's a big security threat from refugees, and refugees are vetted at a level that's completely unlike visa admissions, you know, and therefore we should consider there being very limited or virtually no security threat from Syrian refugees. I don't see honestly how to square that circle. Is there elements of truth to both of these, or is one side simply wrong?
Well, let me draw from, if I may, and I want to, because I want to avoid any accusation of plagiarizing myself, let me draw from testimony that I offered, if I might, at the Homeland Security Committee back in November, and where I addressed this issue quite explicitly. You know, I think the real question is what questions should we be asking about refugee resettlement? Right, and I think it's the security issue is a critically important one, but I also think the wrong question will result in policy, you know, outcomes that don't serve our interests. And so I think in a certain way, it's worth thinking about the question we shouldn't be asking, which is whether the Syrian refugee resettlement program, or, you know, for that matter, any refugee resettlement or even immigration program can guarantee against admission of an individual who has very bad intent. And the short of it is no program can do that. You know, if you want to put this issue in perspective, since 2013, or as of 2013, there were more than 40 million immigrants in the United States. And between 2010 and 2013, about 4 million people entered our country to establish residence of one kind or another. And almost none of these individuals, none of these individuals received anything like the scrutiny that's given to a refugee applicant from Syria.
Okay, let me stop you right there and ask the question, why not? So, like, you know, why are refugees screened at a level that's so far and above what we do for other people who are coming here for residency purposes?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask a different question, which I also think is, and let me get to the question you've just asked, but let me also get to the question that you didn't ask, but I think is a very legitimate question, is why do we let all these people in? Right? I mean, why do we let all these people in? And the answer is on one level is so obvious that you don't, you know, you wonder why it has to be asked, but it's asked. And the answer is because the benefits to this kind of immigration have been so overwhelmingly positive and have so overwhelmingly dwarfed what the risks that are incurred when anyone comes into your country. The United States would not be the United States if we did not have the kind of immigration through the 19th and 20th century that sort of created the vibrant economic dynamic society that we have. And it would not have been possible to run every single immigrant coming into the United States through the kind of procedures that some members of the House several months ago were advocating. It wouldn't have happened, right? So the answer is self-evident. So now let me get to your question, right?
Right.
So,
my question is the converse of
right,
that.
Your question is the converse.
Given how lax our general, and that's just the residency stuff. Then there's the non-residency visas of students and tourists. We let people in with, it's not no questions asked, but it's relatively few questions asked for a lot of types of visas. Why are refugees presumptively so different that they go through this 2 to 3 year vetting process, before we let them in?
Well, we can discuss, Ben, whether whether what is needed in this kind of vetting process. But I think it's not unreasonable to say that individuals who are fleeing situations of conflict, which are in circumstances where it may be more difficult to have easy access to a lot of biographical data, it's not unreasonable to take the position that such people who come into the United States, you know, it's legitimate for us to put in systems that provide some additional scrutiny. I think in principle that is a reasonable position. It's and I think the tough question is how much. What procedures are appropriate, what procedures are redundant, what procedures are unnecessary, and those are legitimate questions. But I think it's reasonable to say in given the circumstances that these populations groups have encountered, it's reasonable to look at some higher degree of scrutiny. I can't object to that, and I don't think most reasonable people would object to that. The question is how much, and the question is are our procedures just so turgid and so under-resourced we're doing these people an injustice. To me, that's the real policy and program question.
So, and what's the answer to that question? In your experience, is the vetting that we're doing through this process, as most members of Congress seem to believe, insufficiently rigorous, and as the FBI has complained, they don't feel like they can do an adequate vet for some of these people based on the information available? Is it approximately the right amount of rigor and therefore we should just accept that unless we decide to take a lot of extra risk by doing a sort of major surge in refugee admissions with lesser vetting, it's going to take a while for us to admit people? Or is it too rigorous?
I think that let me first say the security screening right now, the processes they provide a robust degree of safeguards that more than justify the continuation of these programs. So I've answered one side of your question, and that is, because these reviews, and obviously if I were in the government now, I would have much more knowledge about this, but I probably could say much less about it.
Right.
But it involves reviews by, federal intelligence, security, law enforcement agencies, the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI Terrorist Screening Center, the Departments of Homeland Security, State and Defense, biometric data, biographical data, detailed interviews by DHS officers. I would urge all of the listeners to look at a video by John Oliver on this subject. It was hilarious, but also a great lesson in public policy, and he described some of these, and they really are quite extensive. Now, can the process be speeded up? I think that there are a range of non-security related redundancies in the process that could be eliminated, and a number of non-governmental organizations have written about those redundancies or have expressed concern about those redundancies. Hayas, the Jewish Communities Refugee Advocacy Organization, has done a good study of this, and so I think some of those redundancies could speed the process. Reducing them could speed the process up. Given these security screening procedures, I think our capacity to bring in large numbers of people in a very short period of time is going to be inevitably limited. And for that reason, I think we have to look at other options if we're thinking about trying to take responsibility for large numbers of Syrian refugees, as I think we should.
And what? How do you evaluate what the right large number is? I mean, Obama threw out the number, we're going to take an additional 10,000. And the High Commissioner for Refugees said, you know, no, it should be, I think they used the number 60,000, right? People keep throwing, some entity threw out the number 100,000. So, you know, there's this sort of, people are throwing around these very big, very round numbers, and I don't really understand where any of them comes from. And so I'm curious, how do you think about the question, what's the right number for the U.S. to admit?
Well, that's a great question, and I think before answering the question, I think you really have to think about what are our geopolitical and humanitarian interests in the program. I think that's the first question to answer, because that question drives, at least informs a judgment about how many people we ought to be resettling. And I think with Europe being asked to provide humane treatment for hundreds of thousands of Syrians who continue to stream in, countries in the region being asked to provide not only safe haven, but now things like employment opportunities, school opportunities for children, all of which they should be providing, but with, you know, for well over 4 million refugees, it seems to me that we have an obligation to demonstrate that we have skin in the game if we want to continue to be a leader on these issues. And so why is that important? First, it's important because it communicates this critical commitment to burden sharing. Turkey's hosting more than 2 million Syrian refugees, Lebanon more than 1 million. Jordan's numbers are estimated in the order of about 650,000. If we're asking them, and if we're asking our European friends and allies to take on responsibilities, our failure to do so won't only be perceived as an expression of hypocrisy, but also diminished leadership. I think also we have to recognize that the battle against ISIS is a worldwide effort in which ISIS and its use of social media and other means of communication, they offer this apocalyptic vision of conflict that rejects any notion of the compatibility of Islam and other traditions. So when we have people in our political leaders, talk about, and we, the United States, has welcomed persecuted Muslims from around the world in our refugee resettlement program. It's a highly effective rebuke of this preposterous ISIS notion. But when we impose these bars or unreasonable obstacles to the entry of particular groups, we risk playing right into the narrative that that we're trying to combat around the world. So that all drives me to the belief that we ought to make a significant and substantial commitment on refugee resettlement. It's why I was pleased to have initiated a letter that was signed by 22 former U.S. officials, Republicans, Democrats, former Foreign Service officers, urging not only a substantial increase in all levels of humanitarian aid, but to support a refugee admissions goal of 100,000 Syrians. And there are lots of ways we could have done that. Now, is that an arbitrary number? Not completely. But I think we felt that would represent, it would represent a tiny percentage or a small percentage of the numbers of Syrians who might be in need of resettlement, but it would represent a fair share effort on the part of the United States that would communicate meaningfully that we have skin in the game.
So I hear millions of Trump supporters and Ted Cruz supporters and less politically extreme people gasping when you say that 100,000 number as a cost of U.S. leadership, or as the ante for U.S. leadership, gasping and saying, you're talking about letting in people, if even a small percentage of them turn out to be ISIS people masquerading as refugees, you're going to create Belgium-like cells all over the United States. So let me ask you two questions. The first is, What's the actual history of infiltration of the refugee program by radical groups? And second, of radicalization of refugees either before they come here or after they get here?
Well, the United States, you know, because of the kind of country that we are, because we are a country of immigrants, because we are very diverse, increasingly diverse, and first and second generation or first generation Americans, you know, quickly become much more assimilated than in other parts of the world. We have not experienced that degree of alienation that has that our European friends and have been challenged by, so I think our experience really is in many ways a model for the rest of the world. And I don't want to suggest that that there aren't any challenges, but the future of the United States is an increase. In our path is really laid out ahead of us. We will, in a number of decades, become a majority minority country. Our diversity is increasing dramatically and rapidly. And we have not only the opportunity to continue to demonstrate how we are inclusive and how people come to our country and become American, but I think we have no choice because that is our future. Now, I can't say that there have been no resettled refugees who have been who have been of concern to our security agencies, but the numbers relative to the numbers of people who have come into the United States are tiny, and the numbers of people who have been accused of and prosecuted for criminal activity is infinitesimal, and I think those numbers are really only relevant if you look at them against similar numbers for immigrants generally.
So what's the
you have to weigh those challenges against the enormous benefits to our country in terms of what our tradition of immigration has represented, in terms of the strength and vibrancy of our society, but also in terms of what it represents with respect to our leadership in the world. And our leadership, with leadership comes responsibility, but as we all know, with leadership also comes some very serious benefits to our nation and our people. And to me, that's the context in which you have to look at all these issues.
So what you're describing, though, is pretty diametrically opposed to the political climate of the country right now.
Right.
So the president has said he wants to take an extra 10,000, and that's highly controversial. So the marginal 90,000 that you're talking about is far, is marginal above and beyond what the administration, which is philosophically sympathetic to your point of view, actually thinks is politically plausible for it to get done. Talk about the politics of it. How do you convince people that this is not just importing the problems of the Middle East into their neighborhoods?
Yeah. I think the political challenges are significant and substantial, right? But I think the national interest benefits of sustaining these approaches are, to my mind, significant and substantial, and critically important. And so if that's the perspective from which somebody is coming, then there is a real challenge in how do you communicate that effectively, and how do you exercise the leadership on this issue in the domestic political environment. And I think it's very difficult. I think part of it is much more aggressively working with local communities who have, you know, who have welcomed these refugees, who have seen the benefits of engagement with these communities. I think, you know, there are resettled refugees in each of our 50 states, and our system of refugee resettlement guarantees that local communities become the agents of this kind of inclusion. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, communities benefit by bringing in new arrivals. Here in Minnesota, we're talking to officials about refugee resettlement to address a whole range of issues, including labor shortages that do exist and will grow in this state. And so there's a real openness and an appetite for engaging on these issues. And I think we need to hear more from those voices than we have heard to date. And I think there's a role for the president and the national political leadership in speaking, in not only bringing these groups together, but also speaking out on behalf of these principles. But I don't underestimate the political challenge, but just because it's a significant political challenge doesn't mean it shouldn't be engaged.
If you had to change one thing systemically about the U.S. refugee program, what would it be?
Well, there are a few things I would change. and I tried to, and I worked on some of these issues when I was in the job. Although, let me just give a shout out to the people who work on refugee resettlement and refugee admissions issues in the U.S. government and on international humanitarian issues in the U.S. government. I mean, you know, the United States, in terms of our engagement overseas, we're pretty unique. For better or worse, values play a significant role in the debate on foreign policy and in the execution of foreign policy, and sometimes that can have all kinds of effects. But on balance, I'd much prefer to be trying to make foreign policy for a country in which values are playing a role in foreign policy decisions than one in which they were absent. And I give enormous credit to the people in government in the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration and USAID and elsewhere who are working on these issues. So having said that, you know, I think there are a couple of things I would do. One is I would I think we've done pretty well in terms of the level of assistance. Our program, the U.S. refugee program, is one that emphasizes self-sufficiency upon arrival. And it's not a gold-plated refugee resettlement program. And you can verify that by talking to any refugee in the United States. People really do have to make it on their own when they get here, and they largely do. But having said that, I still think there is more we can do to assist incoming refugees once they're here. I think at the State Department, we addressed a lot of these resource needs during my tenure, and I think the initial assistance that we provide to people, there could always be more, but I think we're doing a reasonable job there. But I think that in the first many months after arrival, where a lot of the assistance programs transfer to the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Refugee Resettlement, and the states and localities, I think there's more the federal government can do at a modest commitment of resources to ease the transition for refugees over the first year, two or three of after their arrival. And I'm not talking about, you know, a gold-plated a program, but a program that gives them a bit better of a capacity to make it on their own, right? Because people need a bit more of a helping hand. So that would be one area I would take aim at in the program. And the second, and this is the one that we've been kind of alluding to during this conversation, is we need to figure out a better way to do rescue in situations like the ones we confront in Syria. Understanding that in the current security climate, we're not able easily to bring, you know, tens of thousands of conflict victims directly into the United States in very short order. And so if that's the reality, the question is, how can we, through our refugee resettlement program, at least begin to think about ways to do better with respect to rescue? And one idea that I've had about this is that you know, we could perhaps be working with friendly governments that are serving as safe havens, and identifying and identify populations within those countries, populations of refugees whom we are committed to processing over time, in exchange for some sort of agreement on the part of those countries of safe haven to provide such safe haven for some limited period of time while we go through our processing. But we need to do better on this issue of rescue than we've been able to do in recent years.
Eric Schwartz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, we need you to spread the word, to promote the Lawfare Podcast, tweet about it, share it on Facebook, Instagram pictures of yourself listening to the Lawfare Podcast. Do whatever you need to do. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.